Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Last year, Zenith Energy in Northwest Portland quietly began exporting tar sands oil from its Willamette River facility. Now Zenith Energy is expanding the facility so that it can handle more than three times the number of oil trains that currently pass through the city. For the past two Sundays, a group of folks from Extinction Rebellion took over the tracks at Zenith Energy in the industrial zone of Northwest Portland, dumping a truck full of soil over the train tracks and planting a victory over fossil fuels garden, complete with sheds, scarecrows, and a real growing garden. Last week, 11 people were arrested. Yesterday, 14 more. Today, we talk with Mia Reback, lobbyist with the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, about why climate activists are taking direct action against Zenith Energy. We also have with us two of the track sitters, Jan Zuckerman and Ken Ward, who is of Valve Turner fame. Mia and Jan, welcome to Locus Focus. Welcome back. And Ken, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi.
Thank you. Hi.
So let's first start talking about this group, Extinction Rebellion, which until a few weeks ago, nobody had ever heard of. And then suddenly the streets of London were filled with people stopping traffic, putting large ships in the middle of Oxford Circus, and otherwise completely shutting down the city. So how is this an inspiration for what you guys are doing?
Well, the mass amount of folks out on the street demanding the truth, demanding the, the taking down of the emissions, lowering emissions. I mean, really getting the word out and taking action was really inspiring. Thousands and thousands of people of all ages.
You're talking about in London?
Yeah, in London.
So that's what inspired you to start working? Because I know, I want to get Mia in here, who was the original person. We're going to be talking about this in a very theoretical way, Mia, when we first planned this show, coming out of the community forums that you helped organize. And then last Sunday, sort of the temper and the temperature raised quite a bit. So I want to first like step back a little bit and talk about what this facility is that Zenith's doing and why people are up in arms about it. And then we'll kind of get into how people are organizing besides sitting on tracks. So first of all, what's going on with Zenith Energy? Who are they and how did they get there?
Yeah, Zenith Energy is a new company that about less than 2 years ago bought an existing fossil fuel terminal in Northwest Portland and rapidly converted it into a tar sands export facility. And I think so many people are outraged about this because Portland has a long history of climate and environmental activism and city and political action as well. So we have this history of movements and people taking direct action from Shell No and this long record of when the community mobilizes, people win. And so people know that direct action is a viable tactic. But people have also been engaging for years, going to City Hall, engaging with the legislature, and in at least the city and county level, passing meaningful policies that commit the city and county to moving off of fossil fuels and completely transitioning to 100% renewable energy. So while the city has all of these great commitments to stop fossil fuels and change our energy system to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in line with our climate action plan and what, you know, 97, 99% of scientists are saying we must do, meanwhile, this fossil fuel company buys a not really operational oil terminal in Portland. It was referred to as a ghost town and a fixer-upper. And they buy this facility and immediately in their first 6 months of operation are exporting tar sands crude out of Portland. And tar sands is the dirtiest form of fossil fuel. It's the most environmentally destructive at the point of extraction and from burning it. And it's also really, really dangerous to transport it and store it in our community. So we as residents of Portland are exposed to this huge amount of risk, and this company is making a lot of money off of it.
So I guess the question is, how did this happen? I mean, they bought this, built this property, and there's a permit attached to it. Is that true?
Exactly. So the previous company was called ARC Logistics, and in 2014, when ARC Logistics bought the not really operational, not doing very much fossil fuel terminal, they applied for permits to expand the rail unloading capacity. And it's important to distinguish very specifically what they're doing. They're not building more storage capacity, more storage tanks. They're increasing their ability to unload oil, which means they can process and move more oil quickly. So while we know that their permits say that they can quadruple their rail unloading capacity, they could actually potentially be moving more than four times the amount of oil they're moving right now. This isn't a limit on how much oil they can move. It has to do with how quickly they can unload the rail cars.
So it sounds like the infrastructure ban for any future fossil fuel development in Portland didn't envision this scenario.
It was known at the time that this issue of throughput, which is how much fossil fuel is moved, was something unaddressed in the policy. So the policy dealing with infrastructure has to do with what gets built. But because these are permits filed in 2014 and the city's policies to oppose fossil fuels were passed in 2015 and 2016, they don't apply to these previously existing permits. But what's so incredibly frustrating is we're dealing with a different company. Zenith Energy bought the terminal in December of 2017, inherited old permits, and we don't actually know as the public if this is what ARC Logistics was planning to do. We know that they were planning to move volatile hazardous substances that is in their permits, but there's such a range of crude oil and toxic chemicals that get added to different types of crude oil that we as the public and our regulators, quite frankly, were left in the dark about what is actually happening.
So I guess the question and why Jan and Ken here have been sitting on railroad tracks is does the city have any ability to stop this? And if they don't, what steps do we take? So first of all, I know that Joanne Hardesty's staff people were at the tracks a week ago, and I heard them speak and was very frustrated with what they were saying, as were Ken and Jan.
They said they had their hands tied, pretty much.
Yeah. And I actually was trying to get Joanne on the show today, but she's busy, so she can't be on. And I'm hoping to get her to talk, because I'd really like to know from herself and not from her staff. I mean, in the same week, she signed a no fossil fuel campaign dollars pledge, and she crossed out the $200 limit and said none at all. And I also think she's come out in support of, I mean, she's very much against what Zenith is doing, but she's also, I got the feeling, in support of what the protesters are doing. But I think we all hoped when Joanne was elected that she was going to be the magic superwoman, our superhero, and change everything. And it doesn't work that way. So I guess I want to get a sense of, is anybody talking to the city and knowing what they are really trying to do?
Yeah, so many organizations, including the Center for Sustainable Economy, the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, and many other environmental and conservation groups are talking to the city. And recently, a coalition of organizations sent a sign-on letter to the city of Portland asking for a series of actions to be taken, the first of which being a moratorium on all permits relating to fossil fuel terminals. So a question to be asked is, has Zenith received all of their permits? And according to a website called Portland Maps that makes a lot of information publicly available, you can go on this website and type in the address of the facility, 5501 Northwest Front Avenue, and it says that they still have one permit that they have not yet received. It's for a fence, so it's not the most direct fossil fuel hook, but at the same time, you know, we can call on the city to not grant any more permits until a thorough review has happened. So there still hasn't been a public hearing. There's been no health and safety review. And while Zenith says that they're improving their safety at the terminal site, the majority of the risk that Portlanders face is along the rail line. And it has to do with the transport of toxic crude along rails that are prone to derailment. And so, you know, that's an opportunity, we think, for the city to thoroughly investigate every single permitting angle, large or small, and not grant any permits until Zenith shows up to a public hearing and publicly discloses what they're doing, allows for health and safety review, and actually conducts spill tests and demonstrates that they can respond to an accident.
I'm getting two deja vus as I'm listening to you talk. One of them is Pembina, which was defeated almost 4 years ago, I guess, somewhere in there. And that was about a pipeline that was how long, like 20 feet or something? It was just a tiny pipeline, and it was going to go through a sensitive environmental area, and so it needed to get an exemption, and it didn't get it through a lot of very strong grassroots activity. So that's the positive one. So that fence is giving me hope, Mia, and I hope that fence can stop this from happening. The other deja vu I'm getting is this very large LNG tank. It holds 800 million gallons of LNG, or will, in Tacoma, which was built without permits. And I was talking with Jan last week, and I said, you know, sort of exclaimed, we're not Tacoma, or are we? So that's my question is, are we? Is there a difference between what Portland has put in place and the politics, the local and county politics here? Is there a difference between what is happening here and what happens in a place like Tacoma, where all this stuff is just pushed under the carpet and Puget Sound Energy just is allowed to build a facility without any permits? Because I remember talking to Jan the other day, and she was saying that if she tried to make a change, if she was doing a renovation in a house and she tried to change something that she had a permit for without going through and getting the permit updated, they wouldn't let her do it, which is what people in Tacoma argue about this tank that's being built. So what is the hope of that we are not Tacoma and that we can actually stop this thing?
And I think it goes to this idea of sacrifice zones and environmental sacrifice zones and places where the industry and government have deemed already so polluted and almost take this attitude of, well, why not build something else? Like, it's already gross here. And I think that's what's so inspiring about what the folks with Extinction Rebellion were putting forward with their actions, is this alternate vision, this ultimate dream of what will it look like to dismantle the fossil fuel industry, move away from dirty infrastructure, and actually clean up and reclaim these spaces and return them and restore them to something that people and animals can use and be in safely. And so I think of, you know, Tacoma and these industrial areas and the Northwest, Portland, you know, fossil fuel terminal hub have these similarities in that they are longtime industrial areas that are deeply, deeply polluted with, you know, long histories of very wealthy industries there. And yet it is time for everything to change. Everything we have taken for granted, we need to reassess in light of climate change. And we can move off of fossil fuels, and we can really bring about this deeper, more beautiful vision of what our spaces can look like. But it's going to take a groundswell of people and activism in every single sphere to stop this project. And so we absolutely need our elected officials at the city and the county doing everything they can, evaluating every permitting opportunity, every safety review, everything that they can do. We need the state legislature in Oregon to pass legislature to regulate rail cars. But we also need people, everyday people, to rise up and to recognize that this construction is already happening. They're not waiting for a public hearing. The company is moving ahead. And so it really is up to people and groups like Extinction Rebellion to step in that sphere of everyday people and everyday action.
Well, one of the things that I'm thinking
about. That was more eloquent than we were planning to do.
Let me ask you.
Thanks, Mia.
Let me just add a couple of very short things, which is in terms of what Extinction.
This is Ken Ward you're hearing right now.
You know, the to go back to your first question, the appeal to me of Extinction Rebellion, other than that the first action I saw them do was to sit down in Greenpeace office in London and demand that Greenpeace, you know, start taking more direct action, which was very appealing to me as a former Greenpeace staff person. But it is to say we don't have, you know, we're now at a point where we can't any longer spend our time trying to calculate what's possible within politics as usual, which is essentially what most of us have been doing for decades, and that's because that's the limits of what was available to us. We have to instead be saying, what is it that's necessary, geophysically necessary, to kind of avoid the very worst here? And that's what we have to bring to our government. So our call, you know, in the Xena situation, is to say to our city and county and state government, you know, there should be no burning of tar sands oil anywhere. That's absolutely clear. The first thing you would do if you were an intelligent government or species would be to shut down all burning of coal and tar sands oil. And that's what the city should be doing. And they have the tools to do that, which we pointed out in an accompanying letter, that they have zoning authority. They could simply rezone the area from industrial to open space. And because we don't have time, and because we want to force them to pay attention to this, that's what we're using direct action to do, to just go out there, stop the trains, which we did for 2 days and that, 2.5 days now, by planting a garden on the tracks. Yesterday, we actually planted an auxiliary garden, a little flower garden, over where they were building infrastructure, where they're rebuilding this train tracks. This is what our government should be doing. We should be shutting that down and returning it to open space with farms and carbon, you know, storing forests.
It wasn't too long ago that the mayor said we have to take deliberate steps to meet our 100% renewable energy goals. And what are deliberate steps? And that's what I'm asking the city. We're taking deliberate steps, but they have to be taken immediately.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about Zenith Energy's plans to vastly expand its oil-by-rail terminal so that it can ship tar sands through Portland to Asia. And we're talking with Jan Zuckerman and Ken Ward, who you just heard, who are with Portland's new, I think its newest environmental organization, Extinction Rebellion. And also we've been hearing from Mia Reback, who used to be with 350 Portland, and she's now a lobbyist with the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. I want to go back a little bit to getting people aware of what Mia was talking about the sacrifice zone that is so much of Northwest Portland, except for the place where people live. And it really... Last summer, I drove through that area down Highway 30 to go out to a barbecue at Sylvie Island. And on the way, I was with this funny guy. His name is Thomas Peabody, Thomas Robinson. And I've known him for a really long time, but I didn't know him in his latest incarnation, where he's a photo archivist. And he knows, through photographs, everything about the history of Portland's industrial zone. And as we're driving along Highway 30, he's pointing out every toxic waste site. He's pointing out this LNG facility that I didn't know was there. He was pointing out all the gas storage and everything. So several months later, these friends of mine that I've been working with in Tacoma, who were trying to stop the LNG facility there, they were coming on the train down to Portland to visit, and one of them told me, as they were going over the railroad bridge and they got to see Portland's tank farm, they said it's bigger than Tacoma's. And it really surprised them, because this is, Portland thinks of itself, and other people in the region think of Portland as this great mecca of environmental consciousness and proactive action to stop fossil fuels. But here we have this incredible sacrifice zone, as you're describing, Mia. So my question is, how do we get people in Portland to appreciate that, no, you don't just live in this little environmental mecca, that there's a lot of serious problems here, and there's people who are suffering not just close to this sacrifice zone in Linton, but all along the tracks, which go actually in both directions, because there was an oil train over in my neighborhood last week, I noticed, sitting in the tracks in the Brooklyn Yard for a really long time. So I don't know if that one's going out of California or whatever's happening. But things are really changing here. So how do we get people to know, to connect with the sacrifice zone?
I think it's absolutely, we live with this myth that Portland is this green mecca, this wonderful, sustainable, environmentally friendly city, and actually it's a hub of toxic pollution. And this is making me think of when it came out about the glass facilities and the air toxics. And, you know, I live in an area where we were told not to eat food that we grow in our gardens, and that we have to do all container gardening because of how polluted it is from the nearby industrial facilities. But there's so many areas in Portland like that. So the fossil fuel terminal hub in Northwest Portland is kind of a ridiculous thing to begin with. It's a soil liquefaction zone, which basically means in an earthquake, the ground is prone to liquefy and is not actually stable to have these large fossil fuel tanks on them. And it's also on an earthquake fault line. Highway 30 is a fault line. So you have a fault line and a soil liquefaction zone, and then it gets decided to put there all the fossil fuels, all the transportation fossil fuels for Oregon and Southwest Washington. 95% of the fuel used in Oregon and Southwest Washington is stored in Northwest Portland. And it's stored in this place with huge, huge risk. If the tank farms explode, if they liquefy and they crash into the river, this is not an environmental catastrophe that has a solution. It is irreparable damage. And so what we need to do is think about a solution before that crisis happens. And I think that's what's so amazing about the opportunities that come with clean and renewable energy, is that they don't have the same risks. There's no such thing as a solar spill in the same way that we could have a tar sands spill in the Willamette River. And we're really lucky here in Portland that we have the Clean Energy Fund that's going to come into effect soon, mm-hmm. and really create a lot of stimulus to support and catalyze that transition.
Unless this rider that's being, this amendment that's being put on for the schooling funding. I'm going to just take a little aside. Maybe, Jan, you want to talk about that for a second?
Well, I mean, I don't. You probably know more about it than I do, but there's that little caveat that would limit the...
Prohibit, I think, local jurisdictions, cities and counties, from taxing businesses, basically, extra. And I forget what there's a term for it. But basically, it would mean that it's targeted right at Portland's Clean Energy Fund.
Do you know about that, Mia?
No, I don't know about it. And... You know, I think that
she brought those emails. Actually, I'll look it up.
Yeah, it's with the school funding, right?
Right.
It's,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, which is really important. So it's snuck in there.
Poison pill, and it's being put in by Republicans.
Yeah.
From rural parts of the state.
And that's a strategy that has happened within the political system at all levels of government. It's one of the reasons why we have the fracking boom. It comes from these riders, things that get written into bills. And it speaks to the deeper systemic change that we need in order to address climate change.
Actually, I have it right here. Democrats' school funding bill includes recently discovered poison pill that would prohibit local voters from taxing mega corporations to fund climate action. So that's it in a nutshell. And Onward Oregon and a lot of other groups, I've been getting these emails for the last 3 days, and they're calling on all of us to really lean on our representatives in Salem to keep this from happening. So I just wanted to point out that we had this wonderful bill that was passed by like supermajority in Portland to fund clean energy, and now it's under attack in the same way that the Trump administration, well, Trump signed an executive order that would prohibit local jurisdictions from being able to have any environmental regulations or states. So, I mean, there's so many attacks coming from the larger scale onto the smaller scale, and it seems we have to be vigilant all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, that's where the power lies in people and in communities. And we will continue to organize ourselves and grow our movements and find these creative solutions and creative ways. And it's just really unfortunate that we have to do this to begin with. Climate change has been known for my entire lifetime. And yet I fully expect to have to spend my entire lifetime fighting for climate justice. And I think that in and of itself just speaks to the deep injustice and inequalities associated with climate change and with pollution, whether it's pollution from fossil fuels or from other industrial facilities. And you can look at every neighborhood in Portland and see the legacies of toxicity and pollution, but also the environmental injustice of who is exposed and what areas are given more of a political voice from governments.
Exactly.
And who aren't.
Well, I want to get back to what you were saying a little bit earlier about, Ken was talking about having a moratorium on all permits, which is what Mia said, and then Ken was talking about changing zoning, and the city has the ability to change zoning and to zone the Northwest Industrial Area as open space. But when I was at the tracks last Monday, when you guys were sitting on them, this representative from Joanne Hardesty's office was saying that if the city were to impose that zoning change, it would get fined hundreds of millions of dollars. So, I mean, there's these political realities.
Said that about the moratorium also.
Yeah, so I kind of want to know about why they think that. And then secondly, is there any validity to it? Because if it's going to cost the city hundreds of millions of dollars to do these things, of course, I think it would cost a lot more to have any of these catastrophes happen. But it puts us in a very hard place, and it's a hard place for negotiating.
Yeah, I mean, we called explicitly. What we're calling for is a degree of courage and willingness to face realities from our leaders in the same way that we're having as individuals to begin to grapple with this ourselves. I mean, like, if you are in any way paying attention to what is happening, we are on track to lose everything that is dear. And at what point do we stop and say, yes, well, we have to stand up and take some risks? Well, if there's any one place in the U.S. that should be willing to stand up and take some risks, it should be the city of Portland, right? Including our elected leaders. So that's what we're saying. We're like, we got people out there that are taking all kinds of risks that are trying to stop, all kinds of things, infrastructure around the world. Most people in most other places who are trying to do this are taking substantially more risks than people in the U.S. I'm talking about putting their lives on the line, right? So here, all we're asking for is a little bit of political courage to step out and confront them. If you get sued, so what? I mean, we're talking about the end of the conditions in which there would be a city of Portland happening within less than a decade. That's what's at line here. So,
I mean, I see this too. That's the long range fear.
It's a pretty short range.
The long range fear is 11 years out when it's all over if we don't do anything about climate change. The short range fear is that next week an oil train could derail in Portland, and that's the end of Portland and into the Columbia River. And if, we could have another Mosier only on a much bigger scale and with a windy day. So that's what I'm seeing. So, Jen, you look like you're about to say something.
Well, no, I'm just thinking about the folks that have been working so hard on this around the Superfund site, and I mean the river and cleanup, and we're trying to work with agencies, just beating their heads against the wall. And I took I did an environmental justice tour with Sarah Taylor and Michael Pouncil and some folks from the Citizen Advisory Group and the Harbor Coalition. And I looked out, you know, we were at Swan Island and looking out at all the tanks and how horrific it was. And I felt so overwhelmed and depressed. And Michael said, you know, Jan, in the big picture, they haven't been there very long. And it doesn't take very long to get rid of them, to dismantle it. And I think we have to have that belief that we can dismantle it. We have to. We don't have a choice, and we need to start now, not tomorrow. We've got to do it, and the city has to have the guts to step up to it.
I'm thinking of these light bulb moments, and I'm going back, is it 2.5 years now, to the hearings the final hearings about the infrastructure for fossil fuel ban for the city. And this guy from Kinder Morgan got up, and he actually was, I was after your students, Jan, this powerful, powerful testimony about why, because the debate was at that point whether there should be a rather large allotment of expansion that was going to be allowed. Was it 10% or whatever? Mm-hmm. And the students are getting up and saying, no, these facilities should not be allowed to expand at all. It's crazy. Seismic retrofitting, which was the thing that was the carrot that was going to be given by the city to encourage companies to limit their expansion to 10%, was that they would then be supported in doing infrastructure to or seismic retrofitting. And the students just made it really clear, we don't have time for that. And it was just really poignant. And the city council is just about crying. And Charlie Hales was crying his crocodile tears. But everybody was very moved by that. And this guy from Kinder Morgan gets up and he says, I feel like I'm at a barbecue and I'm the meat. And then he goes on to talk about how 10% is not enough. They need about 20 or 30% in order to make it cost effective. At which point, after he speaks, Amanda Fritz says, well, you don't think 10% is enough? And he says, no, no way. And she says, well, maybe we shouldn't consider any at all. And it was this beautiful moment. And it was really because of those kids. I think that Kinder Morgan also was a little bit out of their own mind.
They sounded pretty awful.
So I think about those moments and thinking, well, how do we bring another moment like that to this discussion? Because this discussion, I think, is even more critical than what was being proposed 3 years ago.
Well, what's happened in London, and this is the founding of Extinction Rebellion, and what's immensely appealing and to us is the idea that with enough people willing to be disruptive, you can take what is really a second or third tier question and put it front and center in the political discussion. And that's our aim. I mean, that's the aim of Extinction Rebellion, to be disruptive enough that forces the society to pay attention to what's really happening. And that would be a thing that we haven't seen in recent years in Portland as a London-level disruption. And that's what we're aiming for.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about Zenith Energy's plans to vastly expand its oil-by-rail terminal so it can haul tar sands oil through Portland to Asia. And you just heard from Ken Ward, who is probably best known as one of the valve turners. And he's now a founding member of Portland's Extinction Rebellion. And he and Jan Zuckerman, who's also with us, you've both been arrested twice in the last week, basically, sitting on tracks trying to stop the trains. We also have with us Mia Reback, who is a lobbyist with the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. So I want to talk about how we get these goals. Let's first go back to the letter you mentioned, Mia, about that Nick Caleb and some other people wrote, I believe, to basically line out what the city needs to do to stop Zenith Energy from shipping any more tar sands oil through Portland. So let's talk about what was in your letter, and then let's sort of have a little bit of a workshop here where we help the city figure out how they can meet those demands.
So the letter, first and foremost, calls for a moratorium on all permits. So if there's any other permits, any exemptions, any additional asks from Zenith to the city, that the city council themselves, but also that they direct all of their bureaus and associated agencies to deny or not grant any permits until there is a full review and full assessment of the facility. So first things first, calling for a moratorium. then there's some deeper questions about, you know, what the city can do. So we've been talking about the fossil fuel terminal zoning code amendments a little bit here, which was a policy passed in 2016 that changed the zoning code to not allow any other storage tanks to be built at these big facilities. And that's when the Kinder Morgan rep, said basically that they, you know, weren't going to make investments for seismic safety. The oil industry, not surprisingly, challenged that policy right after it was passed. And the city of Portland won the legal challenge last winter and now needs to reinstate that policy. So that is another ask, is for the city to reinstate that policy this summer, to do it in a way that maintains its integrity, does not allow for any weakening or any kind of wiggle room being granted to the industry, and to do that as soon as possible before any other facilities can sneak in any permits and leave us with kind of another zenith situation. So that's another really big ask, is to reinstate this policy. We're also asking for the city and for the county to start to evaluate and look at the risks that come from not just Zenith and the major fossil fuel terminals, but come from the entire kind of set of fossil fuel infrastructures within the city and county. So looking at the entire rail lines, all of the rail storage yards, any smaller storage facilities or distributors, and really assessing from a neighborhood by neighborhood level, what risks do residents of Portland face from fossil fuels? And then starting to develop mechanisms where the companies are established to be liable for any spill or accident or future harm that they do to Portland, to the environment, or to people in Portland. And then to also kind of create a funding mechanism. And so, you know, when we rent apartments or houses, we have to put forward a security deposit. And if you trash your apartment, you do not get that security deposit back. Fossil fuel companies and toxic industries should also be having to pay their version of that security deposit, whether it's through bonding or other financial mechanisms, so they are responsible. And then, of course, we need to be, you know, actually addressing safety. So we prevent the likelihood of a risk. So it's great for the industry to have to pay for it, but we want to just prevent that derailment or leak or spill from happening to begin with. And the real, ultimate, truest way to stop fossil fuel accidents and disasters is to just stop having fossil fuels. And so really implementing that just transition to 100% renewable energy, and doing it now and not waiting, you know, and not saying we have until 2035 or 2050, but saying what are the biggest gains that we can make right now, because we don't have any time to wait.
I'll just point out that there are two letters that went. We sent a separate letter to the city council and to the county as well. And in our letter, we said, what would be the, first of all, we pointed out that the measures that have been taken by the city to deal with climate are effectively a sham. There's nothing in any of the extensive planning that the city has done that in any serious way deals with climate change in any of its various forms. So we noted that. And then we said, if you were seriously to use governmental power to seriously address, which is what we're demanding, what would that look like? And the first biggest example is, of course, to use the rezoning to simply eliminate fossil fuel structure that's in the city, that's anything other than fossil fuels that are used here, and then to immediately go onto a planning system that will get at reducing, you know, that usage. So we suggested that there, I mean, there's plenty of examples. We could certainly look at having the center city be car-free, like many cities in Europe.
Siena,
and there's
Italy.
A whole set of things exactly. That we could look at that aren't far-fetched, that this is a good example of them, and would actually end up, I mean, can you imagine what Portland's going to be like after we get rid of all those fossil fuel things, replant forests and have gardens and get rid of cars in the center city? I mean, it's going to be the garden that it should be. So we're not saying there's going to be costs, and as we mentioned before, there's going to be a need for political courage, but that's what we should demand of our leaders.
Now, I'm thinking about the arguments that you're going to hear against this. And the first one is, this is going to drive away business. And if you have too
fossil
strong,
fuel
it's
going
to invest
yes.
in another kind of business that we want. So I guess, how do we shape that conversation? Because that's one of the things that I've been hearing. In fact, that's one of the arguments against the Clean Energy Jobs Bill down in Salem, which is having some trouble now, and also is getting attacked from the environmental movement as well, from both sides.
Well, but, I think but our how aim do you, is not to shape the conversation. It is to drive the conversation. It's to say, we've had plenty of time for conversation. It's past. It's time to, you know, force these things to happen.
So I want to talk a bit about tactics for a little bit. Now, you have an interesting slogan you painted on the wall yesterday at the tracks. And could one of you tell us what that slogan is?
I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, me too.
I have a picture of it on my phone. If I could, we need to go back and look for it.
There's some debate about the full meaning of that.
Yeah. But was it the time for despair is ending? Has ended? It's time for tactics.
Yeah.
It's now the time for tactics, basically.
Here's how that happened. On Facebook that there's this announcement that Banksy had painted a mural overnight at the Marble Arch, occupation of Extinction Rebellion. And I forwarded it to our friend Barbara Young with a little note saying, hey, do we think we could, get some chalk artists? And she instantly created her version of the thing, and we brought it and put it up. And without spending a lot of time trying to figure out what it means.
But, it can mean a lot of things to different people.
I mean, the time for despair, I'm sort of paraphrasing it because I haven't memorized it yet, but the time for despair has ended. I think I totally agree with that. I'm actually reading Bill McKibben's latest book called Falter, and it's totally depressing. I'll be talking to him on Friday, and we're going to run some of that interview on the news. And so Bill McKibben has moved on from just being freaked out about climate change, not freaked out, but being like really aware of the horrors of climate change, just like tying it into all the rest of the horrible things that could happen that are happening. So in light of that, it's time for despair to end, because if you continue to be despairing, obviously you can't do anything. But that I thought it was interesting that it's now tactics. And I was like, okay, tactics or strategy? I mean, what would be the word you'd really put in there to define what you're trying to do?
Well, I mean, what I took from it, and certainly I think the use of tactics is correct. Another way to think about it is, how much disruption are you willing to take into your daily life? That's the question that I think people have to face. I mean, we're at a point where everyone is confronted with that despair, that sense of despair, and people are doing different things with it. Most people, most of the time, are trying to avoid despair by simply not thinking about it or going into another form of denial, the most extreme being this is all a hoax. But everybody is in some way, dealing with that despair. What we're saying is that the most effective way politically, but also personally, to deal with that despair is to be willing to take a little bit of risk in your life. Because once you have 1,000 people out on the street, you are changing the conditions that are imposing that despair on you.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to add that a lot of people are taking risks all the time by just living in these areas and breathing and eating poison. And, they're trying to survive. So it's kind of looking at beyond, what are we going to do as how are we going to mobilize? How are we going to work together? And there's all different levels of fighting and moving forward.
Well, how do we get those 1,000 people in the street? I'm going to leave that for all of you to respond to.
Well, I mean, that's what we're about.
I'd like to see 5,000 to 10,000. We've had demonstrations here in Portland, 50,000, 70,000 people in the last 20 years. Yep. I mean, if we could get that many people out against the Iraq War, and we can get 120,000 people marching for the Women's March, I feel like this is, I think we all feel this is like the most crushing possibility that we're really trying to address and to try to change before it becomes the unending reality. So this should be concerning everybody. How do we get the entire population of Portland out in the streets?
Well, I think we have to organize among groups and collaborate.
And I think we're dealing with a situation where Zenith began its expansion, and they actually began exporting tar sands crude before their expansion. Mm-hmm. So I think it was the Oregonian reported that in 2018, they did $70 million in business from exporting tar sands crude. And that's before their expansion to quadruple their rail unloading capacity. So they're already doing all this, you know, all this big bad stuff before they're even getting their expansion. But we're just learning about this mm-hmm. as it's already unfolding. And so I think that education is the first piece. And so people who are listening right now, this may be your first time learning about this project. There is an opportunity this Thursday night to attend a community forum on Zenith Tar Sands expansion. This is not a public hearing. We have not been given the opportunity to have a real public hearing with the company or with our elected officials. So in the absence of that, community organizations have been putting on community forums, these educational events, to start to reach out to different people in Portland to talk about the impacts at the terminal site from oil trains and solutions. So you can attend the next community forum on Zenith Tar Sands expansion. It's this Thursday night, May 2nd, at Augustana Lutheran Church in Northeast Portland. Groups will be tabling at 6:30 p.m., and the forum with speakers begins at 7 p.m.
And who's going to be speaking?
There are going to be a handful of different speakers. I'm not sure the exact lineup. I'll be there speaking about what's exactly happening at this facility. There'll be someone speaking about the oil trains themselves and the tar sands and the different toxics and health impacts associated. And I think there'll also be someone from the Portland Harbor Community Coalition mm-hmm. speaking as well.
Yeah, and Audubon also. Yeah.
Is Dan Sears going to be there this time?
Totally Riverkeeper.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I went to the first hearing at City Hall, which was
forum rather,
mm-hmm. yeah, hearing for us to hear, and it was very exciting actually to hear all that information. It was very disturbing, but it was very encouraging. At that time, it seemed like the city was right on board because the city was basically sponsoring it. It was at City Hall. My county commissioner, who I finally found out who my county commissioner was there and was saying really great things. So I got the sense at that forum that people were really trying to address this very seriously, everything from the grassroots to our elected officials. Is that momentum still moving as these forums continue?
Absolutely. The forums have been packed, every single one of them. They're really informative, as you said, but they're also great networking and fun opportunities. So if you're looking for how to plug in to start taking more action, coming to the forum is a great way to get involved. You can also sign a petition against Zenith. It's hosted on the Columbia Riverkeeper website. That's just another way to add your voice to the many others who've already said no to this facility. You can also call or write emails to the City Council or the Multnomah County Commission expressing your opposition and asking them to do something to take action. But I think, you know, we're really in a situation where we do need interventions in all spheres. We need the state taking action on trains. We need the city and county taking action. But politics and policy are not enough in this immediate moment to stop what's happening. And that's where Extinction Rebellion and other groups can come in.
Definitely.
Well, I was really concerned when I read this article that was being forwarded amongst the email activist lists that DEQ had the opportunity to shut down Zenith this past winter when it found out that they didn't do a training. You sort of alluded to this, Mia, but they were supposed to be doing trainings to deal with spills, and they were supposed to do a tar sands oil spill, bitumen or dilbit, whatever you want to call that stuff. And instead of doing that, which would have been harder, and I think their people didn't have any idea how to deal with it, they just did a diesel and asphalt spill, which is what's been going through that facility for a number of years. Somebody at DEQ, Mr. Smith, I think, found out about this and brought it to the attention of his superiors, who said, don't worry about it. So it looks like at the state level, regulatory level, we're not getting any satisfaction. What do we do about DEQ besides sit on the tracks?
Yeah, it's a tough issue. So Zenith moves multiple different types of oil and different products. And so they do store a small amount of diesel, but I think it's about 10% the amount of tar sands that they move. And so I share that kind of reading of the situation that Zenith was not going to be able to demonstrate that they could respond to a tar sands test. And I think that's a question that I have is, why is this company being allowed to operate without proving that they can respond to this? And there's different types of tar sands crude that Zenith themselves have processed in the last year and a half since they've been in operation. And they have different toxic compounds and chemicals added to them because tar sands are so thick that they need these other diluents, these other like toxic chemicals added in
like
order.
Like condensate, really, really poisonous stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And so right now, if you see an oil train in Portland, so you can see those black tank cars, and they actually have numbered placards on them. They're diamond shaped, and that's how you can start to know what is being carried. So if you see a train that has a red diamond placard and the numbers 1267, that means it's carrying crude oil. But it could be carrying many different types of crude oil. And if that same train next to it has another placard that says toxic inhalation warning, that's a tip-off that there has been some gas or other chemical added to that crude oil. And right now we know that Zenith can accept what's called sour crude. That's one of the most toxic types of crude oil because it has this hydrogen sulfide gas added to it. And our first responders are not prepared to deal with a derailment of one of these sour crude trains. First responders have to wear fully contained breathing apparatuses with their own self-supplied oxygen. They're called scubas in order to go respond. And so imagine one of these trains derailing in a neighborhood where there's people at school and at work and at cafes or at nightclubs, and the devastation that could occur is really, really catastrophic.
You need to get the city or Zenith to supply every member of the community of Portland with those, with that equipment.
Well, I need to let listeners know that you're listening to KBOO here. This is Locus Focus on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking about Zenith Energy's plans to vastly expand its oil by rail terminal so it can ship tar sands through the Portland area to Asia. And we're talking this morning with Mia Reback, who's a lobbyist with the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, and Jan Zuckerman and Ken Ward, who are members of Portland's Extinction Rebellion. And as you were saying, I guess I interrupted you, Ken.
Well, I think at the state level, we should be demanding the same kind of thing that we're talking about at the municipal level, which would be we should have a law, and perhaps we should have this by initiative first, that outlaws any new infrastructure, fossil fuel infrastructure, and prevents any transshipment of fossil fuels through Oregon, immediately calls upon serious planning at the state level to reduce the use of fossil fuels consistent with the speed with which climate change demands it. That's what we should be. If we were serious, if we were, not acting in a crazy way, that's what we would do. So
no,
that's what we should
demand. It's not radical.
No. But, you know, I'm thinking here on the one extreme, you guys are sitting on railroad tracks taking direct action to try to stop these trains. On the other hand, in Salem, they're debating the Clean Energy Jobs Bill and trying to gut it, basically. And there's this argument going on between environmentalists who believe that it's really not going to serve the needs it meets, and people are actually calling for it not to be passed. And then there's, and this was something that we did, I did a show on this like 6 weeks ago, and it was a sure thing, and we planned on having the signing show celebration on it last Monday on Earth Day, and it turned out, of course, it still hasn't been brought to a vote. So that's the kind of political reality we live in, where there's all this kinds of negotiating and foot dragging and obfuscation and stuff happening behind closed doors. And how do we reconcile the political process in a democracy, which is fueled by fossil fuel money, that keeps from having any meaningful change? And and what you're doing, which is very direct action, but it's also kind of a limited number of people who are doing it right now, and there's only a limited amount of information.
Yeah, that's
we've
for
had
now.
2 weeks.
We're just starting.
So what?
First of all, it's reasonable for us to understand that we live, especially on fossil fuel questions, we live in an oligarchy, not a democracy. We're not at a point where everybody's individual opinion is deciding fossil fuel or energy policy at all, by any means. And Zenith is the perfect example of that. So, but back to something you were saying before, Barbara, which is like, what do we need in terms of numbers? So what we're taking from the Extinction Rebellion experience in London is that we don't need We don't need vast numbers. What we need is larger numbers, but of people who are willing to disrupt, who are willing to say that everything is on the line here. We cannot continue with just ordinary life as if this wasn't happening. And so we're willing to disrupt stuff day to day to force people to pay attention. And I don't think we need all that many people to be disruptive in Portland or even in Oregon. And right. that's what we're aiming
but
for.
But it seems to me you still need to connect that disruption with very large numbers of people who are going to be putting pressure, because I think we still have to be putting pressure on our elected officials and putting pressures on all the mechanisms of government that are the means that these things are going to change.
Our local government is in no way perfect, but the opportunities for direct engagement with our local elected officials are much greater than at the state or federal level. And so there was that recent story about money in politics at the state legislature. And money in politics is still an issue at the local level, but it's not escalated at the same way as the state. So we have much greater opportunities for people who do want to engage in the political system, if that's the avenue for change that a person is most called to. You know, absolutely want to be encouraging listeners to make calls to the city council, to the Multnomah County Commission, demanding that they pass a moratorium on all fossil fuel infrastructure, and further asking them to send an emergency stop work order to Zenith to ask them to stop what they're doing until there can be a full public review of the health and safety impacts.
See, I have this feeling right now as I'm watching the city's interactions with Zenith and what's going on with Trump and the congressional investigations. And Zenith feels like Trump. It's like, I don't care what you say. I'm not going to do what you want. I'm going to keep building. I'm going to build my wall. I'm going to build my tracks. So I just think that that's a reality that we're having to deal with. And so it seems like we need to put both more pressure and more support on the elected parts of our society to keep them pushing pressure, putting pressure and fighting back on Zenith.
Yeah. And so, you know, we can ask our elected officials to ask Zenith to stop construction. And I think that is something really important for people to do.
But how about ask? I mean, how about force?
And that's exactly
what we're trying to do is force it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so how do you think the direct action you're taking is going to force it?
Well, I think it's bringing it to everyone's attention, getting the message out that we can get out on the streets. We have to get out on the streets. We have the power to force it if we start moving, and not just, I mean, we have to do all of these things. We have to be calling, we have to be showing up at city council, but we have to be, like Ken was saying, disrupting.
I'm wondering about, because I do have this feeling, when I mentioned to people last week, I was going out to the port and I was describing how to get out there, and I'm mentioning streets and they're saying, where's that? You know, Kittredge? I don't know. Is that the place where the dump is? You know, so I really feel like most people in Portland, this is a big difference between Portland and Tacoma. Most people in Tacoma know where the port is because it's really hard to miss. Most people in Portland don't know where the port
is.
And they don't really
completely disconnected.
It's completely, and that's why we think we live in Mecca here. Mm-hmm. So in order to get people to appreciate what's going on in the port, I just was imagining like banners over freeway overpasses and just doing, which is what people did in Tacoma to fight methanol 4 years ago.
I mean, they were kind of one of the unintended consequences of doing this garden. We're calling this, by the way, first garden direct action. We're hoping it'll be picked up as a tactic used all over the place. This is really kind of fun. I mean, it's one thing to go sit on the tracks. We weren't just sitting on the tracks. We planted on the tracks. I mean, now it's a little difficult, it turns out, to plant a garden, have to pick it up at the end of 2 days and then come back and plant it again. We're a little bit worried that the seedlings may have some difficulty taking sprout. So if we had 200 gardeners out there, however, that might help with that. But anyway, one of the unintended things was we ended up with several hundreds. We had 200 in 1 day last week of people from Portland area going and spending a significant amount of time sitting right where you were describing, sitting, watching those gasoline trucks go past,
less
smelling that
every
air,
minute.
Looking at those tanks, and just seeing what an awful place. And it was interesting to see the number of people who I talked to, and I'm not from the area, who talked about in some way knowing what the place used to look like. Like there was a lake there. It was wetlands. It was trees and just that visceral connection to what the place used to be like and what is so, you know, missing in the spirit of the community, not the least of which is that the original inhabitants of the place aren't there at all anymore. So, you know, just having a lot of people come down and spend a little time is a pretty powerful way to make that connection that you're mentioning that's absent now.
But it seems like if there were word put out in other parts of the city to get people to go look, because I think just having sure. a visibility down at the tracks is going to attract a small amount of people opposed to having this visibility all over the city.
And I think one thing that I find pretty surprising when you come down to that facility is how open it is. They keep a lot of rail cars just like right next to the street in this very open way. And I think that can be kind of surprising to people to realize that there's this like super toxic stuff just like 5 yeah. feet from the sidewalk. It's just like right next to you. And I remember reading in the news that there were trains that they had scheduled to unload at Zenith last Monday on Earth Day that were stopped because of the people right. and the garden on the tracks. And so direct action does work to actually make an immediate impact.
Well, right, and I just wanted to add that I'm on the Portland Public Schools Climate Justice Committee, and we're working with Sarah Taylor to bring teachers down there to do another environmental justice tour to get folks there and figuring out how can we get the word out to our students, to our families about what's going on in that area, learning the history and, you know, connecting people, making people aware.
And actually, Sarah Taylor, who was on the show about a month ago, we're going to do a tour, a radio tour. Mm-hmm, and great. I'll record a tour, and then it'll be on Locust Focus probably sometime in June. Yeah. So, yes, I think
Saturday is the teacher tour
okay.
coming up.
Great.
At 9:30.
And I think that it's really important. I mean, this is one of the things we really need to do in the coming weeks and months is to reconnect the people of Portland to our port.
We brought just one last thing is we brought some students down there about a month ago, and they got out of the cars and immediately had to cover their faces, and we're kind of screaming out because of the smell. And I think that is important to get people there, like you're saying. And think about Linton. Think about people that are living there.
Well, we're going to do more on this. So we'll reconvene in a few weeks. How's that mm-hmm. sound?
Yes, thank you so much for having us on.
Today we've been talking with Mia Reback with the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network and Ken Ward and Jan Zuckerman with Portland's Extinction Rebellion. And you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locust-focus. Next week we're going to talk with Columbia Riverkeeper staff attorney Lauren Goldberg and Ali Rosenbluth with Rogue Climate about Trump's executive order that would override state environmental regulations. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.